start out with undergraduate students and your first beginning with them and try and help them to find out about poetry, what are some of the things that you try to clue them into? What are some of the first things that you try to help them to understand that you think that will make it possible for them to make their way?
Reading more than anything else. Reading. And I think writing with an attention to language and an attention to the line. The line is pretty challenging and interesting, and I love prose poetry, but I think poetry has something significant to do, at least at the beginning, that it's very helpful to pay attention to a line. I don't know what the right way to begin is. I think it may differ from time to time because people enter into poetry from different places. I entered into it, I had written just enough that I could overcome my having written a lot without having read much. I think that if someone has written a lot without any kind of idea of quality of language, that it becomes a real challenge to look at the poem as something other than yourself, because you're accustomed to thinking of it as yourself. And it's odd, I was that kind of person, and when I began to read some people that I liked, I realized they were good or great poets. I realized I didn't have the language, so I began to try to construct the language in a very, it was almost like I was writing the poems with sort of emotional erector set, you know, I mean, just like putting the line down very, very consciously. I noticed that if something was very dear to me, that the language would go. So I had a choice between writing what seemed to me to be language that had fiber and integrity and diction and so forth, about things that I didn't care that much about, or writing really bad poems about things that I cared a lot about. And in retrospect, that's not very instructive to someone, for instance, who would start writing poems and was literate. My first teacher said, "You're illiterate." He told me that, and I, to some degree, believed him. And I think most of us in this country, when we begin to love poetry, one of the first things we understand is our own impoverishment as users of the language, you know, and so we have to back up. Yesterday I was talking to somebody who was talking about if you ever go to a really interesting graduate program and you look up people's MFA theses, I think it's really interesting. And I was visiting friends at Iowa after I got out of graduate school, and I went through the library, and it was really interesting. The one that stood out was Albert Goldbarth's MFA thesis. The titles were all things like "The Lamp Under the Blood," or "The Testament of Stoneflies." That sort of title that suggests iodine, you know, that you're the charm of iodine when you first smell it. I mean, it's sort of the exotic title, and Goldbarth's thesis was called Goldbarth's MFA thesis, and it stood out. But another friend there with me was talking about Yusuf Kamenyanka, and he knew Yusuf pretty well, and Yusuf got his MFA, I think it was at Colorado State, or I guess it was at Irvine, maybe. He was at undergraduate school at Colorado State, and then he went to Irvine, and he was talking about how just utterly abysmal Yusuf's MFA thesis was. And that wouldn't surprise me, because I would bet that he began the other way, that Yusuf did begin not trying to construct a language or an image of language, but trying to truly sort of portray the level of his deep feeling at the level he could. I would think he had some kind of stoical resolve, like he'd know when he was awful. And I'm speculating, I haven't seen the thesis. But I think some kind of writers stick with what they feel. from the beginning. I mean, they're just that way. And other people are more pretentious, and I was one of those. And we understand that we can create an image of language that we may not quite know what things mean. So you're writing lines like, the dalliance of shrubbery and the moon undermines, you know, and you go on and on, but each word is occurring as an example of a tone that you approve because it, whatever else, it's not you, and you think, it must be good, it's not me. There's something like that. Are those two very different ways to begin? I don't know. The thing that I believe in more than I should maybe is I think it's very helpful for people to copy poems down when they're beginning, for me too now. You know, if I really like a poem, I like to copy it down to feel the rhythms of it and then to go on from that and write, not with a mind of imitation, but at least a mind that, you know, it's like maybe playing giant steps or something before you start playing your own jazz, you know, just to warm up. And to some degree, it's a matter of getting in the zone. As I've gone on, it strikes me that most people that are in my classes have enough words that they could write really superb poems, you know, and I think that occurs to all of you, you know, and you say, why is, I think tone is very important. I think that there's a big thing, and if you're taking creative writing the way I did and the way you obviously are, to where you can kind of atomize craft, and you can be after a poem that comes from, you know, some deep premonitory feeling or faith about a subject that you find curious or aesthetically provocative or morally necessary or whatever, and you create it bit by bit, line by line, element by element, and then you think, I can revise each line. That's the way I did. I mean, desperately, you know, trying to change each line. But it occurs to me often that if the tone is wrong, and the tone is your feeling, I know it doesn't come across that way, but that's what it is. And if you don't have the tone right, you could revise the lines forever. And it's one of the ways of becoming educated as a poet, I think, when we do that. Others can point that out. They can point out that they don't like a poem, for instance, or it doesn't move them very much or something. And that's very different from saying, I think you should change skedaddle to get out of here. You know, that sort of atomized craft decision. I have a sense that if your tone is right, that if you're writing from your deepest sense of a subject, that sometimes the poem is easier to write. And I think any of us know, and you all should know, I mean, revision is so terribly important, but it's also important not to get locked in revising something where you're really, you don't have your tone and you're sort of climbing up an impossible mountain. To me, it's very important to just blast through some revisions that are just crazy if it's what moves you at the time, to try to get it out and come back. Because I think after you write long enough, you do begin to settle into a tone. And if you've been writing a lot of words for a number of weeks, sometimes you enter a period to where you write four or five poems in a week that are better than the one, if you just stuck on the one, would be in 6 weeks, and you write four or five that are better in 1 week. I think that sort of thing happens sometimes. The other side is the Richard Hugo notion that you shouldn't be too instructed in craft, or you shouldn't be too instructed on how to write a poem. I think we're all interested in that, but it does seem to be a pretty idiosyncratic business how we find our way to a poem from person to person. I guess the other things in the beginning is one of them that I'm not all on board with it seems important to have people being more visual, you know, concentrating on images, being wary of abstractions, having a sense of language and so forth. It bothers me a little bit to get on that horse, to get on it too strongly, but in general, it seems the right ideal. I mean, most people say be specific, be specific, be specific. That seems to be a big issue. It all comes out of that combination of your reading and how much you enjoy it. How much you enjoy it. I get scared of it sometimes. I think everybody who respects the art works in terror a great deal of the time. It's the terror of failure. It's compounded because you realize that poetry is not exactly in your local Walmart, and you think, I'm doing something that is so outrageous. Well, I should do it then. I should do it well. I'm not doing it well. You know, as opposed to most people who are in this, they really like writing. And it seems very important to move out of that mode of where you love writing, not being so afraid of it. I mean, the fear should be maybe one of the latter stages of writing, as opposed to, you know, like the initial stage, which should be maybe self-provocation, but just trying to open. I believe in working myself a lot without thinking of a product, and just writing. And something comes on the fly that will not be, you know, urged into being like a brick building. And I don't want to miss that. I know that there's a great deal of sort of internal verbal diarrhea that issues out of those daily entrances into the journal. If you're working in a journal, I think it's very important to work with certain limitations if you're thinking about using it for poetry. I think writing with rhythm is very important, writing in it with a real sense of rhythm, writing with a real sense of specificity, not writing into the tedium zone in early drafts. This makes workshops problematical, I know. But like, I feel really strongly that if you get bored, that's what the asterisk is for. Put the asterisk and start writing about something else, or copy another poem. At least at the stage where you're generating, generate. Don't get involved in the part that is, I don't know if the word's tedium, because it can be challenging, and understand that the craft level of a poem is very satisfying at some level. But what I'm saying is, it seems like staying in that improvisational mode where your mind is really flowing, to me, is very important at some stage of the game. And you don't get into fear in that part. I understand, too, that that works against a workshop. Any questions about what I'm rambling on about here?
When you were just starting out and dealing with some of those tensions that you've been talking about, who are some of the writers that you turned to help you through that?
Well, it was more of a desperate clinging to the structures of sound that I felt in certain poets, you know, and one of them was, oddly enough, not oddly at all, James Wright was one of them. The Ice House Lights is a great book. I copied a lot of those poems. I mean, at some point, if I liked things, I copied them. And by clinging to them, I mean to say that I would copy them, and then I would try to write to that level. And that's different than being afraid. It's just kind of, am I being good? That constant reminder of, am I being good? Am I being good? Not in fear, but the idea that you could create a level higher than you exist at start with, by conscious thought, I think. There's so many sides to what you're addressing, though, because the other one is just like, I think, like I've always been liberated, turned loose, sent off by reading certain books. I found With Ignorance by C.K. Williams and The Red Coal by Gerald Stern in a bookstore in Denver. And I took them home and they changed everything. I just felt all this enormous sense of possibility. And I mean, to me, when you really read somebody who does it for you, it's kind of a release from the burden of the self. So discovering people, some of the people aren't necessarily good for you or usable. I was thinking of the people who've lately knocked me down. One was Ann Carson. And for a long time, I read Ann Carson, and I would go to bookstores and I'd open it up, and I think, that's not Robert Lowell. You know, it's like that with poets. You think, everybody hated Human Wishes, Robert Hass's book, After Praise. After years, you go back and you say, huh, is that better than Praise? It's certainly different. It's good. But when I read it, I thought, you're not my mommy. It was like that. Some people I couldn't be instructed. James Tate just knocked me down when I started reading. I think everybody who smoked dope and got stoned and read poems when they did, James Tate, you go, wow, whoa, like Lemon Jello in a Dreams Child saying, here's my heart, you know, or like, my girl is the kind of goose who goes cruising through cemeteries snipping the periscopes off graves. Man, that is so clever. It was like the conversations I was having with people about Etruscan civilization, you know, while drunk. You know, I mean, it was like, whoa, this dude's got, but I couldn't get anything out of that. I just, I so badly wanted to be James Tate. The way he stood, he was like Elvis, man. And he was young, and everybody loved him, and it was like, and then when I met him, he'd say, leave me alone. I'd be saying things, who do you read? Who do you read? What kind of ink do you use? You know? Do you think it's possible to really love some people's work, though, that you aren't necessarily instructed by, or that you just, you know, you can't do some things that people do? You're not, the characters aren't kindred enough that...
And Barryman's a great example of that. Nobody could possibly imitate credibly Barryman.
That's exactly right. And I spent a year of kind of like writing stanzas, trying to get to something that Barryman had, and I couldn't get. A guy who was really tough for me was Miwosh. Reading him, I really respected what he was doing. I understood how intellectually tough it was, how full of this kind of stodgy character it was, how unhypocritically political it was. And one of the only things that I took out of my childhood about writing, one of the only attitudes, was that I didn't want to be just somebody who put things down that pleased people. And I guess probably a lot of people who like creative writing are like that. You're the kind of kids who write ain't in your high school, you know, whatever, you know, something that is going to provoke. And I thought I wasn't like that, but when I read Miloš, I saw I was like that. You know, you always see the little charm devil is in you, and it's doing something that's nasty and that's been done by 9 other people. You know, it's like you should be sent to the Catskills hell. You know, I mean, there was some kind of level of reading Miloš that challenged me and kind of held me back like a dam, but that ultimately I was able to get something from it. Some people you can get something from them like the first day you read them. And then there's some people who are just kind of like the vanilla model. Some jazz musician said you got to play the vanilla chords. To me, like, I do not mean this as an insult, but Elizabeth Bishop is the vanilla chord of poetry. You know, she's like dead center. Elizabeth Bishop is at the dead center of a poetry of a certain period. And she somehow doesn't get old, and I don't know how much I can take from her, but she calls you to do things well.
You read that new Bishop, the uncollected book, the Edgar Allan Poe in the Jukebox?
Well, I've seen poems as they show up in the New Yorker, and some of them seem like she might not much like it getting out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just revelatory to realize she could write that. And she could write a lot of bad poems, actually, because this book's like 400 pages long. And Yeah, she, they probably very much embarrassed her. But it made me feel good that, you know, she had
it does me too. That's what we were talking about, was the great joy of hearing somebody you think is really great reading a really bad poem. You know, I mean, I heard Galway Kinnell one time after he just finished the Book of Nightmares. And, man, he looked like Goran Ivanisevic or something. I mean, he looked like an actor. He was, you know, craggy, chin. And he would quote the poems. And it looked like he smelled good. It just looked like, you know, what a physical presence. And he read these things, and they were all just perfectly uttered. And then about 5 or 6 years later, I heard him read, and he just had oral surgery, and he was working on this poem about his brother's death, which turned out, when he finally published it, to be a hell of a poem, but he read it very prematurely out of an emotional connection to the poem. And it was, I'm not saying it was as bad as my drafts, but I know he wrote some lines that I wouldn't have written. It was pretty bad. On the other hand, I think it's kind of encouraging when you see some of these people who write, not first drafts, but some of the people that I like of the older generation, like Phil Levine would say that he'd say, you know, well, I write pretty much when I write a poem, I write a first draft, I go back to it in about 3 weeks and I revise it. That's all he would say, and I think that's true. I think that's true. I don't think he makes he's not a poetry god kind of person. He thinks, well, I'm going to get it down. I think a lot of Merwin's really good poems are kind of first draft kind of things. I think a lot of Louise Gluck is like, sure, she's like sitting there full of spleen and malice and the thought that she's worthless for months, and finally it turns loose and The Wild Irish she wrote in 6 weeks. But my real thought was stupider. It was like, okay, you've got an IQ of about 67. Still, if you work all your life, you may be able to write 3 great small poems. That's one of the other abiding thoughts. One of the things I deeply feel, and I wish it weren't this way because I'd like to be different. Do you know Pessoa, the poet Pessoa, who, of course, he made an anthology. And he created different poets. And they have different styles. But most people who really write well, that I think of as great poets, are past the choice. They might be kind of good at a lot of things, but there's only one poem that they can write great, and it's Full Tilt Boogie. You know, I mean, it's not like they could elect to write this kind of poem and that kind of poem. And I think a lot of critics talk about it as though people have a choice, or they'll talk about, well, why can't Gerald Stern find a late style? You know, it's like the talk about the late style, you know, like there's only one thing that people like Levine can do. I'm sure that Levine could write a James Tate poem. It'd be interesting. There's an anthology out now where all these poets create an imaginary poet. It's certainly an interesting idea. One of the weird things was Mark Strand was there, but he just wrote the introduction for his poet. He created the poet, wrote the introduction, but he never got around to writing the poems. But I guess they thought, well, it's Mark Strand. God damn it, we're going to publish it. You know, so there he is. But I don't think many people could do that. A few people could, but I think for most people, it's like, do you believe this? Okay, how do you know a poem's good? Okay, here's one of the things that would suggest to you that a poem is good. Let's say you have a master poet in your mind. Say the early works of Hitler that you really like, and you think, I want to be like Hitler. And you write a poem, and it seems to approach Hitler. And so that's one of the things, you know. It's like if you're playing music and you're able to play a Jim Hall solo that sounds like Jim Hall, it seems very good to me that if I could do that, which I can't. If you write maybe your own kind of poem, you will not have that marker because you do not know what you smell like. There's that sort of thing, you know, and other people might say, that's really your poem, that's very good. But the poem that I think we tend to prefer, I could tell you, I think behind this poem lingers this ghost of this poet, and that's why I like this poem. There's something to that. But I do think it's some kind of mark of your writing poems, and your being able to understand something about your own poem is just simply asking yourself the question, is this my feeling? It's like if you're learning to play a musical instrument, it's a very good thing to learn the instrument. For instance, to hum and then play, to ta-da-da-da-da, and then play ta-da-da-da-da. Because if you just start depending on that board, you're just going to be like aping it all the way. It seems to me very important that you not let the poem write you. You're all in love with certain tropes, certain large bodies of language that you've loved. And it seems very important that you not just say, I'm going to create this and somewhere there I will edge in and get my little, show my own little butt there. It seems very important that you hold your work to a standard that is, I know that you're all complex and multiple just like John Ashbery, but shouldn't you look at a poem and say, this represents a genuine state of mind? It might not be an enduring one, it might be a momentary one, because I think those exist.